Just before I begin my sermon this morning, I want to remind us of where we are at in this series on Romans. And I put up the outline that Claire and I are following as we move through Romans backwards. So for the last couple of weeks, we've been dealing with chapter 12, verses 1 to 16, a community needing peace. Next Sunday, Claire is going to bite off a big chunk there, 9 to 11, a narrative or story leading to peace. And then we're going to go back to chapter 1, a Torah that disrupts peace, and then finally end with those great chapters 5 to chapter 8, the Spirit creating peace. So that's kind of where we're headed. And just to remind you again, we've been saying that the big story of Romans is the story of God's reconciling purposes for the world. Reconciling you and I as individuals, as communities of faith, and indeed God's purpose and plan is to reconcile all of creation. You'll have to wait till we get to chapter 8 to see just how big and how cosmic that picture is. Let's pause for a moment of prayer. For you alone, God, our souls in silence wait. From you, God, comes our salvation. Amen. Why does someone have to win? A young rabbi came to a new congregation, new for him, and he found some disturbing patterns. During the Friday Sabbath evening service, half of the congregation stood for prayers and half remained seated. And each side shouted at the other, insisting that theirs was the true tradition. And nothing this young rabbi did could solve the impasse. After a couple of weeks of this, in desperation, he decided to go and visit the founder of this synagogue, the synagogue's 99-year-old rabbi who now lived in a nursing home. And he poured out his troubles to this older rabbi. "So tell me," he said, was it the tradition of the congregation to stand or to sit, or to stand during the prayers?" "Nope," said the old rabbi. "Ah, so then it was the tradition of the congregation to sit during the prayers?" "Nope," answered the rabbi. "Well," the young rabbi said, "what we have is complete chaos. Half the people stand and shout and the other half sit and scream." "Ah," said the old rabbi, "that was the tradition." All communities of faith come up with their own traditions. Some even more foolish than that, perhaps. Richard Kaufman is a Mennonite writer and pastor and a former professor. And he once wrote a little article claiming that kitchens are the most contested space in the church. Now, I should give you about 30 seconds just to think about your own kitchen stories, your church kitchen stories. I'm going to come back to that later, but think about it for a moment. How we conduct ourselves in the kitchen, he says a lot about who we are as disciples. So this being the actual Thanksgiving weekend, we also celebrated last week. This being Thanksgiving weekend, it's appropriate that we talk, have a conversation, I think, about food. You and I know about disagreements. If you've been in the church as long as I have, some of you longer, you know that there are always challenges in terms of unity, getting along, differences of opinion, viewpoints, some profoundly theological, and some just differences of personality that make it hard to get along. This morning I just want to review this story from three perspectives and then offer some concluding comments. The perspective of the weak, the perspective of the strong, the perspective of Pastor Paul, and then a few of my own observations. But I do want you to notice, just before we begin this, this section follows those words of Paul in chapter 13 that Claire talked about several weeks ago. Talked about through me, I think. Chapter 13, verses 8 and 14, remember? "Owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law, and then the other, instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ," the image of clothing. "Put on Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires." Flesh doesn't mean a physical body. It means our own natural desires to be contentious with other people. So, keep those in mind. And one other word from Robert Frost, those of you who like poetry, remember that great poem, Mending Wall. And he says this, before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Those words are worth thinking about when we get into a disagreement. Who am I walling in by my behavior, and who am I walling out? I thought briefly what would might be effective, more effective than me standing here motionless for about 15 minutes, would be for Claire and I to construct a wall here on the stage, and then we could both stand on either side of the wall and talk at each other, to you, and over each other. And the higher the wall went, the more we would wall each other out. It would be a very vivid visual perspective. But given all the other protocols we have to deal with, I thought we'll go for the tradition. So let me begin with a perspective of the week. And imagine for a moment, as we've been asking, inviting you to do, imagine the perspective of the week. Imagine a person, a young Jewish woman named Deborah. Deborah is a free person. She's not a slave, but she kind of lives on the margins. What are the struggles that she has? Well, Deborah was exiled along with the rest of the Jewish community and Jewish Christians. They were exiled from Rome. After about 6 years, they were invited back. And as they come back, they have found that the church has changed. When they left, the Jewish Christians were the majority in the church. But now it's a Gentile church. They sing different hymns. They sing different songs. They conduct themselves differently. The potlucks look different. And Deborah feels like she has low social status. She has no power because Jews have always been under suspicion by the Romans. Romans think they're lazy because they take a day off. Jews call it the Sabbath, but the Romans think it's just being lazy. And in other ways, they discriminate against Jews. So Deborah feels like she has no power. And the church has changed. And yet Deborah brings a lot to worship. She has a proud heritage that she has heard from her grandparents and from her parents. The Jews, after all, are the elected people of God, chosen out of all the nations to be a light to the nations. They have the Torah, the Old Testament, which they love and which they try and practice. And they worry. Deborah worries about God's judgment on her and the rest of the Jewish Christians if they compromise their convictions about diet and about keeping clear boundaries. Sometimes they still attend synagogue services. They see no conflict between being Christian and also attending synagogue. Deborah and her fellow Jewish Christians value the practice of Sabbath and of a particular diet. These boundary makers of Sabbath and diet have sustained them for hundreds of years. Through exile, through persecution, the Jews have always been a distinctive people because of the way they live. It's very public. And so now Deborah and her family has come back to a Gentile church that would have left them feeling powerless. And the changes, especially in the teaching, would have been disturbing. And Deborah doesn't know about this Paul, this guy who's written this letter. She's heard rumors about Paul, how he's lax on the law. You know, he's a freedom lover, as he puts it, libertarian. He doesn't care so much about the Jewish traditions, even though he is himself, was born Jewish. And then he's sent as his chief spokesperson, Phoebe, a Gentile woman. So Deborah and her family come with suspicious minds to hear this letter that Paul has written to them. They feel like they're being coerced by the strong, the majority. I want you to notice one word that sort of begins this section, chapter 14. Some translations say, welcome those who are weak in faith. That's not a very good translation. Better, Paul puts the onus actually on the majority, on the strong. He says, welcome in faith those who are weak. See, you hear the difference? Not the weak in faith, but welcome in faith those who are weak. It changes who the pressure is on. You see, the weakness that Paul is writing about doesn't imply that their religious devotion is thin or that they don't grasp the basics of the Christian life. One of the points Paul might be making is that the weak have not fully worked out the implications of the gospel. Someone says it's akin to someone driving down the highway, posted sign 110 kilometers an hour, but they're only going 70. They're going to be cautious. Don't you love being behind those people? So the weak are those who haven't necessarily fully worked out the implications of the gospel. But Paul never suggests that they're holding heretical views that are opposed to the gospel. In fact, later on he will encourage them in this text, if you think the law is important for your faith, keeping those Old Testament boundary markers like Sabbath and diet, if you think they're important for the faith, then practice them, and the strong should accept them. But also, those who practice those boundary markers shouldn't necessarily impose them on the new Christians that are part of the fellowship. So that's Deborah's perspective, speaking as a Christian Jewess. There's a rather vivid picture of how the weak might have felt being picked on by the majority and the strong. Let's look at the perspective of the strong. And here I want you to imagine Marcellus. Marcellus is a young man. He's a Roman slave. And he discovered the Christian faith through others' witness, other slaves witnessing to him. And he's been excited to be part of this church. He's been part of this church now for several years. He doesn't know any, he has no tradition with the Old Testament. He doesn't know Torah. He doesn't know any Jews because they've been exiled from the city for years. But he loves the way this church gives him freedom and accepts him for who he is. His status has risen dramatically in church because in church there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male or female. So in church, he's on an equal par with everybody else, and it's wonderfully liberating for him, because when he goes home from church, he's a slave, and in Roman culture, the owner can do with you whatever you want, abuse you and work you almost to death. So church is a liberating experience for him. And he's Gentile, he's Roman, so he has more social power than the Jewish Christians. And as I said, he doesn't know, he's not familiar with the Old Testament, and doesn't really care about those practices. Marcellus understands Christianity as freedom. Diet and special days don't mean anything to him. And when these Jewish Christians come back, Marcellus and some of his friends begin to belittle the practices of these strange new people in the congregation. Why are they hung up on that stuff? Don't they know Christianity is freedom? They consider the weak, as they term them, as legalists. And it seems, reading these two chapters, 14 and 15, that the majority is ruling without any regard for the feelings and the emotions of the weak. Marcellus is convicted, though, when he hears Paul's words, because Paul says, the weak are not to judge those who think they are strong, but it is only the strong to whom Paul says, change your behavior. He doesn't say the weak have to change observing the Sabbath and change their diet. It's the strong who need to change their behavior of sort of lording it over those others. So Deborah and Marcellus, weak and strong. Thirdly, we have the perspective of Pastor Paul. Paul would have heard about those tensions. He would have heard about the Jewish Christians coming back to Rome. And perhaps he was afraid that these Jewish Christians would just throw in the towel and they'd go back to the synagogue and chuck Christianity. For Paul, this would be a travesty. It can't happen. That would be nothing less than an offense to the gospel of the cross and of God's kingdom of peace and justice and joy. And so Paul is guided, motivated to offer some counsel. And he offers several principles for living together as a Christian community, as weak and strong. The first principle, he offers words of encouragement. Welcome one another. Encouragement, by the way, is one of the spiritual gifts that Paul had mentioned earlier in chapter 12 of Romans. To encourage someone is what? It's to build up their confidence. It's to build up their hope. It's to encourage certain kinds of actions. Encouragement is a positive way of engaging those with whom you disagree. The word welcome, as I've already said, is the key word in this text. It brackets 14 verse 1 to 15 verse 7. This group is nursing antagonisms, and maybe they're even starting to peel off and worship in separate silos, and they can't get together even for worship. What Paul encourages these Christians to do, especially the strong, is to extend not just tolerance, not just put up with them, but he wants them to be welcomed. He wants them to welcome the weak. He wants them to receive them into their homes and into their friendship groups. I like the way Eugene Peterson translates those verses in chapter 14. If you eat meat, eat it to the glory of God and thank God for the prime rib. If you're a vegetarian, eat vegetables to the glory of God and thank God for the broccoli. Easier for some of us to do than others. Paul encourages the group not to despise each other. To despise carries overtones of contempt and arrogance. You see, Paul says, you are responsible not just for your behavior, but it begins with your attitudes. Because those attitudes lead to decisions which separate and keep them apart. Accept the other, Paul writes, without attempting to settle doubtful points. The weak should not judge, and the strong should not pressure the weak to accept its views. And one other word of encouragement in 14 verse 16, do not let your good be blasphemed. In other words, by your disunity, by the way you are bad-mouthing each other, you are providing a very negative witness to the larger culture in Rome. You are hurting the witness to Christ. So the first word is encouragement. The second word is exhortation, that is, responsibilities before rights. To exhort someone is to emphatically, urgently urge someone to do something, to change a kind of behavior. It's actually turning up the impetus of encouragement. Exhortation is very forceful. In chapter 15, verse 1, there's a translation problem. In many of our translations, it says, we who are strong ought to put up with the failings of the weak. Just listen to that. We who are strong ought to put up with the failings of the weak. It's kind of patronizing, the tone there. I don't like that translation. Even though they're better scholars than I have worked on it, I don't accept that. How about the Revised English Version? Listen to this change. Those of us who are strong must accept as our own burden the tender scruples of the weak. You get the change? In the first, the strong just put up with the failings of the weak. It's completely almost dismissive. In the second translation, those of us who are strong, it still is maybe a bit patronizing, must accept as our own burden the tender scruples of the weak. The onus now is on the strong to act in a way that respects the conscience, the emotions, the tender scruples of the weak. So now the onus on the strong is not that they're the best and they know the right way, they know what's right and so on, but now it is a burden to enclose the weak in their care and understanding. To do so is to exercise their freedom, not sacrifice it. Rights take a back seat to responsibilities for the community. The Common English Bible also has another translation, so I wrestled with these three versions of this verse. And I like it too. It says, we who are powerful need to be patient with the weakness of those who don't have power. That very much addresses the status issue, right? As I mentioned earlier. We who are powerful need to be patient with the weakness of those who don't have power. In all of this, Paul is exhorting especially the strong to change their attitudes and their behavior. They need to be more concerned about the growth of the body than their own freedom, and not to please themselves. Now, it's true, the personal convictions of all believers is important. Paul never dodges that. Christians, though, need to respect the faith commitments of their fellow believers, even when they sometimes lead to different ethical conclusions. You see, the danger in self-righteousness lies in its tendency to make my own convictions the measure of everyone else's convictions. And if you don't measure, your convictions don't measure up to mine, then you are just plain wrong, and you're probably outside of God's will, as we used to put it in some of the traditions I grew up in. So Paul says, exhorts them, change your attitudes, change your behavior. Be tolerant. But tolerance has its limits. It doesn't mean that anything goes. Paul wants to focus this third principle, the example of imitating Jesus. If you read chapter 14 and 15 very carefully, you'll see something very significant. In chapter 14, verses 1 to 12, Lord is used 10 times in about 7 verses. In other words, Paul is underlining that Jesus Christ is the central consideration in any discussion in the church community. Every behavior, every attitude we have must be oriented towards what would Jesus do? What would Jesus expect? Every attitude and every action gets its validation only in light of what Jesus has done and what Jesus expects from us. Whether you consider yourself weak or strong, whatever your status, all, Paul says, are equally obligated to live in a way that honors the Lord. In verse 9 of chapter 14, Paul makes an interesting statement. He says, Jesus is the living Lord. That doesn't sound very new to us. But the way he puts it is unique in all of his letters. He writes this, for to this end Christ died and returned to life so that he might be the Lord. Christ returned to life. Usually Paul would just say Jesus rose. But here he uses this phrase, returned to life. I think he puts it so pointedly because he wants to remind the Roman Christians that everything they do in the presence of the risen Lord. How would that change our conversations when if we were tempted to answer in anger or self-righteousness or self-justification? How would that change our behavior and attitudes if we realized that the third person in the conversation is Jesus? And Jesus has expectations of us. Imitate Jesus because he is the living Lord returned to life in our midst, who's interested in our behavior right here and now. Paul also says Christ did not please himself. He modeled self-giving. And he quotes a text in chapter 15 from Psalm 69. Psalm 69 is used by the gospel writers as part of the passion story of Jesus. It's put on Jesus' lips several times in Matthew, Mark, and in Luke. Psalm 69 refers to suffering. It's a sobering text. Why does Paul use it? Well, I would suggest that one of the things he's suggesting is when believers insult each other, when they inflict pain on each other, that church conflict falls on Christ himself. That's a sobering thought. Our conflict, our behavior, our unchristian actions in conflict fall upon Christ himself, and once again Christ suffers. Surely this would curb some of our judgmentalism. True table fellowship, true welcome is, Tom Wright says, is what justification by faith looks like when it sits down at table in church. And one other point. I said Paul uses Lord 10 times in about 8 verses at the beginning of chapter 14 and throughout this whole section. Paul is making one other point, and we'll come back to this later in later sermons. Paul is making the point that if Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not. And that's also crucial in this discussion, as I said earlier. If the Christians are squabbling, it's a poor witness to their neighbors. And it means Caesar is Lord, because that's what the Romans did. The Romans depended on status and benevolence and so on, and they put people in their place. But the Christian church is not like that. If the church divides along ethnic lines or tribal loyalty, it's still living in the world of Caesar. So, welcome one another. Our responsibilities come before our rights. And primary of all, we are invited to imitate Christ. Paul doesn't expect everyone to be on the same page. That's obvious if you read these chapters. But ironically, a lot of contemporary readers don't like Paul because he isn't on their page. I said that Richard Kaufman, this Maronite writer, had said that one of his theories is that the church kitchen is the most contested domain in many congregations. He says, if you want to understand the politics of a given church, start with the kitchen. Who's in control and what conflicts arise there? A long time ago when I was part of a congregation, I wasn't a pastor, but this congregation had some kitchen issues. They sponsored a community meal, and some newcomers came to the church, and they disagreed with the way things were being done in the presentation of this meal. Basically, it was a discussion of, should we wash all the dishes or should we just use disposable plates and stuff? And it got to be very conflictual. A discussion that went on in the kitchen of the church and in parking lots and in other people's kitchens, and sides were taken, and the discussion got pretty heated. In this case, I'm happy to report that the majority, who wanted to go with the way they had always done it, sort of use disposable paper plates and stuff. It saves a lot of cleanup time. In the end, the majority gave in, gracefully, I think, and they found a way to go forward in peace. But it happens so easily and so innocently, doesn't it? Back to Kaufman. He says, although we haven't developed a theology for it, the church kitchen and the fellowship hall are really an extension of the sanctuary and the communion table. We don't eat together because we're physically hungry. We can get good food at home too. But eating together is another way of sharing our lives and our discipleship together. And we always remember that Jesus is the unseen but present guest with us as we break bread. And so our spiritual lives are enhanced by our table fellowship. So it really matters. And that's maybe why we sometimes have conflict about it. One of the sadnesses, for me at least, is that we haven't been able to share food together in a potluck because of the COVID-19 pandemic. To share food is also to live in imitation of Christ, and hopefully we'll be able to do that again. I look forward to the day when we can dedicate our new kitchen and where we can eat together and celebrate together and encourage each other. Of course, food is generally not our issue. Although in our day, when I was younger, I don't ever remember a discussion about vegetarianism versus meat eating. Now it's a little more lively, and that's probably a good thing. But food is generally not our issue. We have other issues that we struggle with as a church, not just our congregation, but as Mennonite Church Saskatchewan and Canada, and even the larger interdenominational church. Issues around what is healthy sexuality. Issues around politics. And where do we draw the line between conscience, our own conviction, and our responsibilities to the others? We differ sometimes over worship styles. Who changed the hymn book? It'll be interesting to see some reactions when Voices Together comes out, because some of our beloved hymns may not look quite the way you remember singing them. We have our issues, and one of the questions I'm not going to answer this morning, but we struggle with, is what is the value of tolerance as a virtue for Christians, and what are the limits of tolerance? Where do we draw the line, and this cannot be tolerated as a people who are followers of Christ? There's a wonderful old English proverb that says this: faults are thick where love is thin. But God demonstrates the opposite, and to a greater extent, faults are thin where love is thick. I think that's what Paul is trying to say in these two chapters. Faults are thin, differences don't matter when love is thick, substantive, when we are dedicated to each other in imitation of Christ. We're going to sing a song now, The Welcome Table. It's a beautiful song that summarizes some of what I've been trying to say this morning. May we find joy and grace in accepting our differences and even celebrating our differences, and even more in celebrating and embracing that which unites us. Amen.